Accession number 12713, Mr. Tony Temple, reel 6.
Mr. T. Temple, reel 6. Have you any other outstanding memories of Shanghai, Mr. Temple?
Yes, one in particular I would like to mention. The whole period of Shanghai was more or less a state of routine. And once we'd got into that routine, we didn't vary so very much. But one particular aspect was the GOC's inspection when the whole battalion was on parade. And the usual retinue were coming round, inspecting the men, asking questions, getting their answers. Usually the answers were always the same, in favour of the army and whatever it was. Well, they came to the band, and one lad in particular, Milligan, a young boy, my particular friend as a matter of fact, and he was asked by the GOC how long he'd been in the army, how he liked it. And he said he didn't, and of course this set the looks at variance and daggers at young Milligan, coming from the adjutant, the RSM, the company commander, the usual thing, the whole retinue were round him in a crack, why don't you like it? So these questions were fired at him. Of course, the lad was in a bit of a flummox. He didn't know what to say. Afterwards, when the parade had finished, he was called to the company commander's office and he was asked why. And he said, well, we don't get anywhere, which we didn't. You had to have an advancement to a company or a bugler to come to you go out. You couldn't go out with a rifleman. You had to go out with either a bandsman or a bugler. So consequently, they didn't want you tagging along where they were going, so consequently we never got anywhere. And then they started arranging visits for us to the YMCA swim baths, and we went to one particular place. It was rather interesting. The French consulate's wife decided to invite us all for tea one day a week. Well, this was very nice and all, but after a couple of weeks, she were playing draughts and dominoes and what have you. Incidentally, she was English. And it was tedious, to say the least. It was very kind of her, but it wasn't the sort of outings that we wanted. The YMCA wasn't too bad because you could swim. We were all interested in playing water polo, all the water sports. But this was as far as it got. We got no more. The whole idea just fizzled out because there's a lack of interest on behalf of the army, not sufficient interest to provide the boys with something on the outside. The outings, again, I suppose we were limited to the international concession. We had no trips upriver or anything like that, you know, which would have been proved interesting. No interest to interesting places, no visits to interesting places. Consequently, the life was pretty dull. As you say, we couldn't get out. And this was towards the end of it. So our education, so far as Shanghai was concerned, was very, very limited indeed.
So during the whole of your time as a boy soldier, you had a pretty well sheltered and controlled existence.
Yes, I think it had to be. Well, when I reflect, at the time, of course, you don't think of that. You think of what you can do to enjoy yourself and so forth, like the other fellas. But when I think of it, you're thrown into a theatre of war, the Sino-Japanese war was at the time. There was still fighting going on round about Shanghai. The authorities, I suppose, had that in mind. Well, we've got to look after these kids because there are, you know, one lad was only 15. When you go out to a theatre of war at that age, they've got to be very careful because the colonel, the adjutant, they'll be the ones that we're going to be shot at if anything happened to that young lad, you know, anything going out. They were the ones that we're going to shot at. So I would have thought, yeah, well, fair enough. When I reflect back on it, they've done the right thing. But I don't think they've done enough to keep us occupied, other than, as I say, our own bit of music, the occasional sport, and even sport was limited. When you think that there's only one regiment out there, or two regiments at the time, the C4th and ourselves. So sport between the two battalions on boys was extremely limited, because you didn't have enough to make a good football team, or with boxing team, or hockey, or whatever sport it was. So we couldn't be employed in boxing. I suppose this is one of the reasons why they said, all right, let's go to the YMCA, where we used to go two or three times a week, which was to fill the interest in. We had no swimming pool within the barracks. So this was fairly handy, But it was, as I say, a pauper's existence, really. We had, as well as not getting here, we didn't have very much money to spend. So, in all, it was an experience to be out there as a youngster, but it would have been better for us socially if we'd had a lot more to do rather than just sitting in the barracks the whole time.
Were there any attempts by any of the boys to break barracks, to go out on the road?
Yes, we eventually, one or two of the bandsmen or buglers would say, right, fair enough, we'll take you out, but as soon as we get out of the barracks, you can go on your own and make sure you're back by 9 o'clock, which we had to be in barracks by 9 o'clock. And this used to happen occasionally. And we were always, again, though, you were strictly limited to what you could do, because none of us were drinkers at the time. For all you know, what kids are trying to drink before they're 18, sort of thing. Smokers, very few of us smoked. We weren't encouraged to as bandsmen, of course. So you were limited to theatres, cinemas. And incidentally, this is the first time we used to go to the cinema, an American cinema that was down on Bubbling Well Road. And there was no smoking allowed in the auditorium at all. You could have a drink served in the house, you could have a bit of a snack served at the seat. But there were, no, this is going back, you know, 1937 we're talking about. And here is today, we're only just thinking about banning smoking in these various establishments. Yet in Shanghai, they were doing it in 1937. You dared smoke in a cinema, you were asked to leave immediately. And you never got back in there, if they knew your face. But this is one of the things, as I say, a cinema, and that was about as much as you should get to. Plus the fact, mind, we did used to get out with the band on these various engagements. But again, this was military. When I talk about entertainment, I'm talking about something which is not military. So we were really confined a lot.
Where were your next experiences? Where did you go to next?
Well, we left Shanghai, I think it was in the November. And we went to North China, Tientsin.
Which year was this?
1938. We only done a year in Shanghai, and then we went up to Tientsin, ostensibly to do a two-year tour of duty in Tientsin. In actual fact, it was Tientsin and Peking. The detachment of a company was always at the British consulate, or had barracks in Peking next to the consulate. And the main body of the battalion was left in Tientsin with sufficient troops to disperse along various places, such as a summer camp we had at Shanequan. Which was somewhere, mind, it was a lonely place, right on the edge of where the Great Wall of China started, which was just looked like a load of rubble that was gradually leading in. But as you went further inland, away from the coast, then they really started building it. But where it really actually started at the sea was just like a huge mound of sea, sand and grass that was growing on it. You know, that's all it looked like. That was our summer camp. We used to spend a couple of months here, the year down there, providing we had no engagements, of course. Very cold place in winter, extremely cold place in winter. And much the same, I suppose, routine was very much the same as we had in Shanghai, but I think we got more of the standard guards and so forth. Where we had these outposts in Shanghai, we didn't have them in Tientsin, nor did we have the international concession. Each country had its own concession, like the French, the Italian, our own, and the Americans. And still, we were, again, still very friendly with the American Marines who were up there. The French we didn't bother with, the Italians we didn't bother, except by way of football matches. Again, but this was purely and simply on a company or a battalion basis. It said the boys would never include in any matches up there at all. Unless we could get into the company teams, some of the other, Dave Milligan did, for instance. He was a useful footballer. This was the lad who created the furor in Shanghai. Very much the same there as it was in Shanghai. But the guard duties that we used to do there, anything up to about 15 guards, half a dozen to a dozen men, depend on the size of the place that we were guarding. Now, this was the normal procedure in any place, wherever we were sent to put a sentry going guards on, we would do it. But in winter, it was really cold, so cold, in fact, that the sentries on the outside, wherever they were standing, were only allowed to stay out an hour at a time. Normally, it's a two on and four off. But this was only an hour on and two off. And it came to such a position that you were dressed in such a fashion to keep out the cold that if anything had happened, he couldn't possibly do anything. I mean, He was had a fur hat to start with, which he brought tied under his chin. All this was done before he went on to St. Ego, of course, and he tied under his chin. Then he would have his normal khaki uniform on top of that, and his cardigan underneath his jacket, then his overcoat on. And then we had a sheepskin coat over the top of that, which went right down to your ankles, and we had sheepskin boots to pull up to your knees. Well, they were always fastened up, so, and he had a right mitts on his hand. No, to try to handle a rifle or try to fix bayonet with a rifle, it was just a hopeless. Really, it was nonsensical. It really was, because he couldn't have done a damn thing if anybody had a real mind. And he never did. The guard never had any problems at all with civilians. The one of the biggest problems that we had out there was the rioting that used to be created by the Chinese, but was always incited by the Japanese. They would, at any time, they would, because we were still surrounded again by Japanese right away around us. And we always had on standby, and I remember what we called emergency platoon, that was that platoon or whoever turn it was, whichever company had to supply it, detailed to say they were standing by in the barracks, never left the barracks the whole time. And as soon as the alarm sounded, which it was again all bugle, as soon as the alarm was sounded from the guard room by the bugle on duty, they would assemble with full fighting kit at the guard room and pile into the transports, and away they used to go down to the wherever the site, wherever the occasion was happening. And on this one particular occasion, I remember, it was very distinct. When they reported to the guard room, they were given their live ammunition. You never carried live ammunition in a barracks. It was always, you know, doled out wherever it was in the guard room. They dished everything. I think it was about 10 rounds a man. There were 5 rounds in his pouch and 10 in his, 5 in his magazine. And this particular regiment, they dived onto the transport, and the way they went with the adjutant flogging the transport on, gets out, pulls out the line into him. The thing was, when the way they used to deal with him was that they had a sniper always with him, man who was trained marksman. And the adjutant would just stand next to him and say, "You see that man so and so," he would describe him, and then just down him. No problem, do it, just shoot to kill. That was him down. And invariably, it all broke up. Once you got the ringleader, it all broke up. But this night they went down there, the usual place, just outside the boundaries where we were. And he lined his men up, the adjutant lined the men up and said, "Got the sniper right on. That man there, down him." "We forgot to get the ammunition." Well, the adjutant, quick thing, a Fox Davis, he's quick thing. He said, "Right, oh, out, bayonets, fixed bayonets on your rifle." And he just had him walking towards the, with the cold steel. Well, that was enough fun. When they saw the cold steel, they all just merely dispersed. But these were the sort of jobs that we used to do. Not the band, of course. We were exempt from such menial tasks as this. But this is the job of the rifle companies, and this is how we used to deal with the with one of the aspects of the life in there. Another aspect, of course, was protecting British property. Mainly, this is why we were there, to protect the British property, coal fields, warehouses, ships. Again, it was not one of those things that when a ship was due up the river, we would send a section of men out with a brain gun to stop the pirates from boarding. And when you tell, you know, you relate your experience to some people, they say, "Pirates in those days, never such a thing." But the China seas was loaded with these fast-moving junks. From the time, and they're probably still going on now for all I know. But certainly at the time, merchant ships were always at, they were very vulnerable for these blokes because they were really crafty. In actual fact, they would try to get some of the men on board as part and parcel of the crew. And this was one of the reasons why we used to have to send blokes out there and take them back out again till they might reach the mouth of the river. Once they're on the mouth of the river, then we're on our own, and we had to come back again. Same with coal mines. If there was any problem there, we'd just send maybe a platoon of blokes under the command of the platoon commander, sub-lieutenant or lieutenant. And this was the sort of life that was going on the hotel. You kept fairly busy. And as I say, these guard duties that we used to do, when you're talking about 12 to 15 guards at a time in any one day, because we changed every day, every 24 hours. I suppose, 500 men in the battalion, and split into four companies. The four companies would probably maybe have 80 to 100 men. It came along fairly frequently.
Did you have any ceremonial tasks in Tianjin?
The only ceremonials that we used to have was the usual beating of retreat, which we used to put on every now and again. entertain the Chinese or any important visitors which came up. But again, the band was involved in engagements all over the place. In fact, some of the bands were pretty good musicians, and the North China Philharmonic Orchestra used to engage them to go on their concert, do their concerts for them. Quite a number of them used to do that. And again, our dance band used to get quite a number of jobs. Again, you were playing officers' mess. If the sergeant's mess had a dance, of course, you had to play them or the other ranks. If they had a do in the canteen or wherever it was, we'd have to play for them. You were kept fairly busy and still giving concerts in various parts of the town, some of the universities, wherever. And we used to visit, we get out quite a lot. All paid jobs, of course, as they always had to pay us. You know, I've already explained what the situation was with regard to that. You used to get money in, and it was so much went to the band fund. And the rest was shared out in shares. Then each depend on rank as to how many shares that you got. We had a fairly busy life, more so in Tianjin, I suppose, because there was less demand. Could I put it this way? There was the smaller the place, we had a greater demand, because when you have a large demand, which we had in Shanghai, a large city, we used to get invited at various places to do various jobs. But other regiments were doing the same, like the Seaforth, the Welsh Fusiliers. Then we had the American Marines. They were also busily engaged in a similar sort of thing. Whereas in North China, we were the only band amongst the whole lot. The French had a trumpet band of some sort. It wasn't any match for ours at all. So consequently, we used to go to them and the Americans' concession to place there, the American Embassy, British Embassy, when they had functions on. Even the Italian Embassy, we used to go to their functions. And the Italian Embassy, the concession, was manned by Italian Marines. Fine fellas and all the pick of the Regia Marina, as they used to call them. All fine-looking chaps, big fellas. Something similar to all guard regiments at the time, because you couldn't join the guards at the time unless you were 6 feet. You had to be 6 feet or more. So, all in all, we were kept fairly busy on there, but that cold weather always used to defeat us. We went to one funeral. One of our lads had committed suicide. But he was given it. He was not supposed to have had a military funeral, but he was a well-known character. He's a great sportsman in the regiment. They decided to...
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Scott, Corporal Scott. Good rugby player. One hell of a good rugby player. All various sports, boxing and that. And I think it was the trouble with VD, and he didn't like it. One of those things that... he would have lost his stripes immediately, you know. And I think he just committed suicide. But we gave him a funeral, and unfortunately it was in the middle of winter. And as I said, winter up there is very... You don't get a lot of snow, but the wind is so cold, so freezing, that we went out and we're marching down the road playing the Dead March from Seoul, and the instrument just froze up. You know the valve for the brass instruments are for releasing the saliva. Not so much with the woodwind, but certainly the saliva. But even the keys, you know, with the dampness of being blown through, the keys were stiffening up on the woodwind instruments. So we just gave it up as a bad job. And we carried on, and the only bloke who'd done anything really was the bugle section when they blew the first post in Henry Valley. And then we marched back. We tried again coming back, but it was no good. Couldn't get a bleep out of them. Not a thing.
What were the attitudes of the British civilians towards you at your level?
I wouldn't say this is a difficult question, but it's one that gives me the idea that these people who were out there on jobs, much of the same that we'll be doing a class, I suppose, a middle class in Great Britain, in the UK. But when they were out there, they always used to think that they were somebody. And, of course, we weren't treated as well as we thought we should have been treated by these same people who were nothing in England, yet when they went out there, they were the dog's body. Well, in some cases, we just didn't get on. We just didn't get on at all. This was especially notable in the various places where we used to play with the dance band and the military band, to these hunt balls and so forth, you know, these... You could see that they were trying to be a class above the rest, but in actual fact, some of them weren't even as good as the working class that were in Britain, but they had this class about them. So we didn't get on well with them at all. Not at all.
They didn't try to make your position any easier?
No. In fact, they were making it worse by the attitude that they took to us. if they'd had an attitude like the French ambassador's wife in Shanghai, that would have been a different kettle of fish. Mind it didn't stop us enjoying the tour of Tientsin, but in Peking. But certainly that I wouldn't have thought, you wouldn't think that they would treat British soldiers as if when they were there for their protection. And we didn't like it at all. And they never altered their attitude towards us. Only when some trouble started, then you were the hero of the day sort of thing, you know. So we didn't really get on with them.
Did they have a different attitude towards the officers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You see, that this is where they were thought that they were class. And, of course, the officers used to think the same about them. They were... we had some... A couple of officers, for instance, who were moneyed boys in their own right in England. They were society lads, like D.R.C. Irvine and... Norman, Lieutenant Norman at the time, he later became Major Norman, who was at the time, he was the nephew of the Governor of the Bank of England. You know, those are the sort of people that we had with the regiment who really had money. Duck Mason, he was a grandfather, about 6'4". And in Blacktown, he was the bloke who had one of these big motor cars with a big aero engine in. And he used to scatter his money around, as soon as he would push his car to get it started. We had all these people with money, but they didn't think very much about supposed to be class people that were out there, the civilians, you know, they didn't take to them at all. They used to attend all their functions, naturally, which was they had to. If the commanding officer said that you went there, well, you went there, there was an end to it. But they knew what the score was. One of those things, Harry. That's part of life.
How long were you in Tientsin?
We were due to spend 2 years there, but the war intervened. Now, this was a rather peculiar thing, that we had some floods in Shanghai, in Tientsin, and the barracks were flooded. We just woke up one morning, and about 6 o'clock, I suppose, when we found that the water was lapping the beds. We wondered where it was come from, because there hadn't been any torrential rain so far as we were aware, but certainly up in the mountains there must have been. They have created this... And it was actually coming up through the drains and the high tides at the same time, so we were really in the mire. And we'd lost all our kit, was underwater. And lo and behold, about an hour later, after we were getting ourselves sorted out, the Navy came up through the past the guard room in a rowing boat to help try to get us salvaged. That was, I suppose it was laughable at the time to think about, like the Navy coming up through the rowing boat and the guard room to give us make a rescue, which they did do. And they took most of our stuff to a Cox and King's warehouse on the riverside. We were up on the higher decks. But being the elite of the regiment, the band, the gentlemen of the regiment, as they call us, we were billeted in the British Consulate office, in these office and his house. He wasn't there at the time. And this brings us on to the situation when war was declared. We'd had the crisis in Shanghai, then we had this one coming up. And we were all sitting around playing mahjong and playing cards and so forth, because we had nowhere to go. The instruments were underwater, you know, we couldn't do anything with them. There was virtually nothing we could do. And the telegram came through, the usual Chinese, put the telegram in, just to the British consul. His name was on, I can't remember his name now. And they said, well, what's going on? He's not here, he's away. So it's Banshan and Silver, I have a look at it, see what's what. He opened up, and all it had on was War Germany. That was how we knew about the crisis, but this is how we found out that it was in plain English, War Germany. And that's when the problem started with the, we knew that we were going to have to leave there this winter. After the floods had subsided, we got back into barracks. And we cleared up the mess with the help of an army of Chinese. We got back to somewhere near normal. And of course, we realised that we were going to move back down to Hong Kong. And it was during this period that the Japanese knew that we were going, that there was two converted merchant ships at the port, the Wangpo was down on the river, the Mangpo. And the train was pulled into the Tientsin station, because we'd got the blokes down from Peking, so the whole battalion was going to go to, I'll think of that name, that port, just a minute. We went down to the railway station, and the Japanese had put a guard across the entrance to the station, no, you can't get through here. Fox Day was the adjutant at the time, and I said, a quick thinking bloke, he just waved the carriers, Bren gun carriers up, and there was about 5 of them that we had. And they just said, right, or you should just go straight through the barriers, and if they start anything, open fire. But they didn't. Fortunately, there was nothing created. He just opened fire. They just moved the barricades up. We got on the train and we went to this port that was on the wrong pole.
Had you had any notion that war was coming in Europe? Had you had any information or?
We realised in Shanghai the 38 crisis had started, and that particular time the Seaforth Highlanders were also in Shanghai with us. They were billeted in the race course. They left, went back down to Hong Kong, and I think it was with the Welsh regiment, they also went, only left us, in actual fact, up there in Shanghai. And after it all fizzled out, they came back again. And the similar thing was happening to Shanghai when it started to come. We could see in reading from the papers and listening to the news from home, well, we knew that something was going to go on, of course. And we were wondering how we were going to be dealt with, whether we were going to stay with the concessions or whether we were going to come out of it, until they finally decided to pull the troops out of China altogether. So we left Tianjin, Peking and Shanghai and went down to Hong Kong. And we were got there just before Christmas, just before Christmas Day, I think.
What were your own feelings as a relatively young boy, young man, that you were going into a war situation?
Well, it was nothing new to us, Harry, because we'd had this conditioning of semi-war, from the time we landed in Shanghai. As I said, from the time, even from when we were passing Spain on the troop ship on the way out, there was a war situation there. And when we got to Shanghai, of course, in that war situation, he was still in a war situation in Tianjin, North China. And Peking was very much the same, because we were surrounded there by Japanese. We didn't think a great deal about it. Your mental thoughts are that, we've got to do it, we've got to do it, this is our job. And we went back down to Hong Kong. It took us about 4 days, 5 days to get down there, because there was no non-stop. We were straight through with an auxiliary cruiser from Australia came up to escort us down. But at that time, there was nothing doing over there. It was straightforward. And we got to Hong Kong, got ready equipped for war. All our burnished equipment and all was all painted over. So it was sad, it really was. And they had nice, lovely polished boots. They looked like patent leather, you know. Oh, dear me, put dubbing on them. They dull everything down, you know. It was terrible, that, really. And the nice bayonet blades all had to be painted a khaki colour. It was terrible to see that all that years of polishing now being thrown on. It was laughable, really.
Had your role now changed from?
Yes, we'd left our instrument. We took our instruments down to Hong Kong with us, and we were told when we arrived there. We went under canvas in Kowloon. That was, Hong Kong is the island, but we were on the mainland, Kowloon, under canvas, because there was no barracks at all that was to spare at the time. You remember, there's three other regiments had come down at the same time with us. And when I say three other regiments, you've also got the servicing regiment, like the Service Corps, Engineers, Ordnance Corps. They were all had their detachments as well with us to look after our needs. So they were all coming down to Hong Kong as well. And on the face of it, when we reflect back, I was pleased to get out of Hong Kong. I'm pleased we did move out of Hong Kong. We were just mobilised for war from there, and that we packed our instruments up. They went on the ship with us to Egypt, to Suez. And as I said, we were selected, and the band, as I've already explained prior, were always trained, even in peacetime, as stretcher bearers. And we assumed this role. Because there was about 40, 45, 50 of us, perhaps, there was too many, in actual fact, so they decided to create an intelligence section, that some of us would have to go on the intelligence section. So I was nominated as one of the intelligence section. And although I was still under 18, I mean, I was only 17, they said, "Oh, you still have to do this. You still have to do this." Fair enough. That's no problem. And the others went on, as I say, on stretcher bearing. This is where you all started. You started stress training thoroughly for war, in the sense that the medical officer was then, reinforced our training by lectures on various things like blood circulatory system, the systemic system, the nervous system, whatever. We had to take these, even, moving from Hong Kong by ship, these were going on daily by the medicals. And then in midstream, they were on board ship, and they suddenly said, "Wait, Temple, you are now going to be back to the stretcher bearers," because one of the lads had left to go into a rifle company, and I had to reinforce them
You were only in the intelligence section a very short while.
Oh, yeah. We were given the jobs that we were going to do, but of course we went back on the stretcher bay when I was told. And one of our jobs was doing Batman for the medical officer. A Captain Sheriff, of all names. Captain Sheriff. And silly man.
Why was he silly man?
Well, you see, I was appointed as a batman to him. I look after his needs, much the same as every other officer has a batman. He joined us in Hong Kong. He was the regimental doctor for us, I suppose you'd call him, the MO, medical officer. And we met each other, and he told me what his needs would be and how he'd like his standards, what his standards were. And we got on famous for the first few days. Great stuff. I liked him, a little fella. And then there was one day that the inoculations were called for. We were going into Egypt, and there was various inoculations that they called prior to war and everything else. And blood groups and all that had to be taken. And I was doing this stuff, and I'd missed the actual parade. And I'm thinking that, oh, well, medical officer, like, I can just go down and get it when I've got some free time. Because all his stuff was being, the whole regiment was being converted to from, you know, peacetime to wartime. He was the same. So I was having to do all his work as well as my own. And I missed the parade, and he put me on a charge for missing the parade. As I said, silly man.